This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey out there, rock and rollers. Welcome to the 67th edition of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, recorded here in central London, just off Historic Abbey Road. And we have so many exciting things going on with the podcast. I'm bursting to tell you all about it. Now, for all you longtime listeners, listen, we appreciate you being with us. You, me, the Wolf, Mac B, and Action Jackson, you know we love to talk classic rock, hard rock, prog rock, heavy metal, early MTV, all the stuff that turned us on when we were young rock and rollers, and everything we've grown into over the years. We love rock music. We want to share it with the world. These are conversations that we've been having for years, and all we really do now is hit record. And there's stuff that we like that we want you to like. We need the world to know about the stuff we like because we know it's awesome, and we want everyone else to know about it as well. Just recently here, very big news for the Wolfcast. We've become a member of the Pantheon Podcast Network, which is a really amazing network of cool podcasts that are all about different kinds of music, not just rock and roll like we like, but all sorts of different kind of cool ones. But it also has some great rock and rollers like the Appice Brothers, Carmine Appice, and Vinnie Appice are on there. The Shout It Out Loud guys, you've heard us talk about many times on this show, with the best Kiss podcast in the world, they're on there. Vintage Rock Podcast that has amazing rock interviews. Pamela DeBar has her own podcast on there. The legendary, I guess you would have to call her a rock groupie, but let's call her a muse, especially in the world of Led Zeppelin. So we couldn't be more excited about being part of this network to help us grow and improve our show. And we've got a lot of great stuff coming up in the future here that we can't wait to tell you about. We'll get to that here soon enough. Now, speaking of Led Zeppelin, our show today features an interview with an author who wrote a book about a young woman's quest, her search to find the legendary Led Zeppelin guitarist, Jimmy Page. Of course, Jackson and I worship Jimmy Page. We love the music of Led Zeppelin. We've done a couple of shows on Led Zepp over the years, and I'm sure we will do more in the future. But Christie has written this novel, and yes, there's some autobiographical elements in it, which are in every book, in every novel, everything you read will have some kind of personal experience in the protagonist or possibly the antagonist story there. It's a story of Luna, who's a young girl. She loses her mother. Her mother had this thing for Jimmy Page, and she inspired Luna to then go and find Jimmy Page. What does he mean to her? Actually goes over to England to search for him at his many houses and at a guitar playing contest in London. And she's a wonderful author. She's a great conversationalist. And she knows her stuff. She knows Led Zeppelin. She knows Jimmy Page. The book takes place in 1988, which is when Jimmy Page's Outriders solo album came out. And that was a big deal for us because we were in high school. Christie's about the same age, so we're getting turned on to this music about the same time. I think it was a very big moment in Christie's life. And it was important for us too because now Led Zeppelin, well, are they going to maybe get back together? What's Jimmy getting back in shape here for? We didn't know. But it was a big part of her life. It was an inspiration in her book, and we talk in depth about the record here on the show. So we need to dive into that. Also want to give a shout out to Talita and the Sheepdogs. The Sheepdogs are a Canadian rock band who kind of have a 70s southern rock feel to them, little Allman Brothers. I could hear a little bit of Molly Hatchet in them and a little bit of 70s funk and soul. Their UK PR person, Talita, got in touch with me, invited me to the show. I went to see them at the Lafayette this past weekend. And they were great. They were great live. If you check out the Sheepdogs, I think you'll like their music. But to see them live is really the best way to see them. Kind of the mark of any really great band. I guess it wouldn't make them unique that they're great live. But if you hear their records and I think you like them, don't miss out on a chance to go see them live. And they're going to be touring Europe here later this year. So definitely go check out the Sheepdogs. And thanks to Lita. It was a lot of fun. All right. That's a lot of buildup. But this is a really fun show. We're so psyched not only to be on the Pantheon Podcast Network, but to have our first guest as part of that network, author Christy Alexander Hallberg, the author of Searching for Jimmy Page. We're going to get into her book and the Jimmy Page's Outrider album and all things Led Zeppelin right here on The Wolf. How's the book being received? I mean, I see all sorts of reviews and stuff for Searching for Jimmy Page, but how's it being received overall? Are you getting some sales?
Yeah. No, it's not easy when you're with a small press, a small university press, so I don't have this juggernaut behind me to help with publicity, and all of that's basically had to come from me. So it's been a slog. It's really been a lot of work trying to get the word out, but it has been paying off, and Alice Cooper did a promo of the novel
that's
on his
huge
radio show.
Yeah.
That was really a gas. I was excited about that. And I launched in New York at KGB Red Room, and that was really fun.
Cool.
So it's you know, for the kind of book that it is, it's doing well.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's great to hear. We know what it's like to be independent, trying to get the word out, you know, but it seems like you've really been hitting it, though. I mean, getting on lists, getting in clubs, you know, going, doing podcasts, doing interviews, whether it's on the radio, getting out to bookstores, you know, getting it over here.
Right.
But so well done.
Well, thank you. And that I'm such an introvert that this has been really difficult putting myself out there. And I think most writers are introverts. I mean, you work by yourself.
Right.
So really getting out there and being on stage, so to speak, is nerve-wracking. But it's also enjoyable. I get to meet people like the two of you and talk to a lot of interesting folks. So it's a good thing.
It's got to be a little bit hard because, I mean, I've never written a book before, but to go through this process, you have this idea, you put it together, you put it out there, and then it's kind of like, I hope you like it, but you know, it's I guess my thing is what really bends me out of shape now is people that they put time and effort into something, and then all people want to do is, well, it's not very good because X, Y, or Z. Okay, first of all, have you ever done whatever? Have you ever directed a movie, written a book, done anything like that? Then be quiet, because like I said, it's your passion project. Like, you wanted to put this out on the street, and then you're just hoping that people will enjoy it as much as you enjoy bringing it to life.
Yeah, it really is my baby. I don't have human children. I have book babies and fur babies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost 20 years in the making from start to finish.
Wow.
So, I wanted to be a writer since I was about 7, but I really think if there's anything that I was meant to write, it's this. So I have that extra passion behind it. And when you release it, there's that trepidation, like you were saying, like, how is this going to be received? Because I put my whole heart and soul into it. I may have blown my wad. I hope not.
Right.
I hope there's more left. But yeah, I gave it my all. And I just really hope one day it gets in Jimmy's hands. I would love for him to read it. And it really is such a love song to him, to my mother, to my brother, to my late husband. It's just all of this stuff. He's all wrapped up in my relationships with these people and has been a constant in my life since I was 15. So it would be wonderful if he could not only read it, but read it in the spirit in which it was written.
I was going to take the Jimmy Page tangent. So if you want to talk to her about the book, Jackson, give her the question.
That's kind of what I think that's where we both wanted to go right off the bat.
Yeah.
was Jimmy Page. I mean, to me, the concept for the book or the story could have been Searching for Anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It was Jimmy Page. So I guess, I mean, I'm guessing this is your question too, Mac. Why Jimmy Page?
Well, that's a personal reason. It's because, as I was saying, he's all wrapped up in my relationships with people who have been the most important people in my life. I'm the youngest of four. The next to the youngest is my brother, Steve. He's 10 years older than I. And he was a rock drummer with various bands around my hometown, Greenville, North Carolina. And I just thought he was so cool. I just kind of hero worshipped my brother, and he loved Bonzo. John Bonham was his absolute favorite rock drummer, period. And so I grew up hearing the name, everybody knew Stairway. Everybody knew Whole Lotta Love. Sure. But it really wasn't until I was 15 and came home from church with my mother one day, and Steve was on the living room sofa at our house watching The Song Remains the Same. Mm-hmm. MTV was broadcasting the movie. I think it was the first time they broadcasted in 1985. And
cool.
I had an immediate and visceral reaction to seeing that. And I think the first image I caught when I walked into the room was Jimmy playing guitar. And I'm sure you've seen the movie, yes. How he's dressed in that kind of esoteric outfit. And I'd never seen anybody do to a guitar what he did. And then he goes on and he plays the theremin, and he bows the guitar, and they have these fantasy sequences interspersed with the musical sequences or the live sequences. And it was just mind-blowing to me. And it was like the Messiah had arrived for me. I was this 15-year-old girl, small town, Eastern North Carolina, 1985. And I was interested in a lot of things that my peers weren't, and things that I guess would have been considered a little bit taboo, sort of the darker elements of nature.
Right.
And so here's this band, and in particular, this one figure, this one person who kind of crystallized all of that. So the alchemy was there. It all came together, and the music was brilliant. Each individual in the band was brilliant.
For sure.
And Jimmy just kind of represented this thing that I was missing and looking for but couldn't really articulate. So my mother was this old-fashioned Southern woman, and she's sitting there watching me watch this, and I'm sure she's thinking, oh, God, what are we in for now? And then within weeks, she's helping me hang Led Zeppelin posters all over my bedroom walls.
Nice.
And she's having to listen to me talk about, because I had my brother had all their albums, and I had him record them on cassette for
me. There
you
go. Yeah.
And I could play them on my Walkman. So, and blast them from my own tape player in my room.
Yeah, it was Maxell 90-minute cassette. You put one and two on side one and two. You could put three and four on the Houses of the Holy.
Absolutely.
And in Through the Outdoor. And then you could put Physical Graffiti on one 90-minute cassette. Yeah, sure. Everyone did some of that.
Yeah. So I just became this passionate fan from the get-go, and that has never wavered. And, through my own personal loss and tragedies, the music has been there. Jimmy has been there. So, I like what you said, that for the reader, it could have been searching for anybody. For this writer, it could only have been searching for Jimmy Page.
Yeah, and I want to get into that. Now,
I will have to say that getting into Jimmy Page, I knew Led Zeppelin. I was a fan of Led Zeppelin, but I remember the kind of the backstory between Mac and I. We were roommates freshman year of college, and the first thing that he did was put up the Jimmy Page poster with him and the double neck, the EDS 1275.
That's right.
And I just remember thinking, that just looks like it doesn't make any noise. It doesn't move. It's a poster, but it just looks so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's
So you guys go way back.
Yeah. I mean, we're about the same age as you are. I think it hit for us about the same age, 14, 15. Freshman, sophomore year, maybe a little bit in the eighth grade there. And I want to touch on some of the themes you talk about growing up in the South in the 70s and 80s, especially if you're just a little different, how polarizing that can be in the community. But talk about Jimmy Page a little bit, guys. A lot of rock stars are worshipped, but there's something about Jimmy Page. He is really beloved and beholden by so many people, and it's by men and women. Usually it's one or the other for a lot of rock stars. Like, the girls gravitate to one guy and the guys gravitate to another. But for Jimmy, he's pansexual. Everyone likes Jimmy, it seems. He has this aura about him. He's amazing looking. And, I gotta say, I was a skinny little white kid, and when I had the long soccer hair in the 80s, I'm like, well, now I've got long black hair. Don't I look like Jimmy Page? Am I not, it's someone I could look up to and relate to very much, not to mention the way he played guitar was like nobody else whoever did. So his aura was something different to me.
Yeah, I, in some respects, and I don't mean to make a comparison between Jimmy and Prince, but they both had that feminine and masculine energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's to what you're saying, Mac. There was that duality. Or is that duality to Jimmy Page? There was a definitely a feminine aspect to him, but he exuded this. I mean, look at the power chords he was playing.
Mm-hmm.
That masculine energy that came out was unmistakable and very attractive too. So that duality extended also to this kind of light and dark image that he gave off. There was something a little bit dangerous about him, and also something really angelic about him. And I play with that in my novel.
Absolutely, you do. No, it's a very well-written book. I'm so glad you brought it
Thank
to
you.
Our attention. I will admit that as a business guy, I have not read a fiction book in decades. Okay, like Bill Clinton was president the last time I read a fiction, something like that. You know, because you have to read a lot of contracts in my work. When I was in banking, I had to read prospecti and legal stuff, not to mention the journal and stuff like that. When I was in startups, you know, I had to read a lot of contracts and things. And then for fun, I don't know, I'm into rock music and I like to read a lot of biographies and autobiographies just so I can learn more about what I love. And so I'm reading through this and I'm like, I'm enjoying this. And I'm like, because you're not just watching a movie to get your fiction the first time in a long time. You're actually reading a book, man. Good for you. But I think the fact
I'm honored that you read it.
Well, of course. But I think the Jimmy, tying Jimmy in with it is a great way to hook in those who are like, well, you know, I'm not a fiction guy. Or I'm not a fiction reader. It's like, oh, but it's about Jimmy Page, so there's something about it I'll be able to relate to. So yeah.
All right, that's great. I love that you read it. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, the last time I read a book, a nonfiction book, or actually a fiction book, it would have been something in the Hardy Boys catalog to my son. So yeah, same kind of deal. I am not a big reader, but I think that the real trick for this is, can somebody who has no connection to this? This is about a young woman. Young girl, young woman growing up in the South and what she goes through, that has nothing to do with me. But can I read this and be engrossed in it? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, I was like, I wanted to know what happened. I wanted to know. And yeah, it was the Jimmy Page thing. I will have to tell you, not to spoil the novel for anyone, but after reading it, I've canceled my Action Jackson summer tour by bus. Because the way that you describe it in the novel is horrendous. The bus station and the people on the bus. And I was like, oh.
Well, I spent 4 days on a bus when I was 22. I rode from Greenville, North Carolina to San Jose when I moved to California. I didn't want to drive it. I didn't want to fly. I wanted to do the Jack Kerouac kind of romantic, let me sit on a bus for 4 days and discover America.
See, the real people, the grit, and, you know, what it takes to get across.
Well,
right? Yeah.
I encountered a few gritty people on that trip in bus stations in the middle of the night. And then there's... I don't want to give away too much either, but there's a scene in the novel when Luna doesn't have enough money for a ticket on a bus and she's in the UK, and that happened to me. And I went from London to Liverpool and didn't have enough money to get back to London to my hotel room. I had miscalculated the direct deposit in my paycheck and I was on a shoestring budget to begin with, and I didn't have enough money for the train, and went over to the bus station and discovered I didn't have enough money for a bus ticket either. So you'd have to know me. I'm this sort of square kind of, you know, unassuming person. But you know, when you're desperate, you're desperate. The bus driver turned his back and I jumped on and went to the back and pretended to be asleep the whole way from Liverpool back to London. And luckily he didn't ask me for my ticket. So there's some tidbits of autobiography in the novel.
Well,
sure.
I was curious about that. I mean, obviously you have to write what you know, and you mentioned how you've had some loss in your life that kind of helped set up, you know, the story here a bit. But you're always curious about the details. I'm like, did she really get a cabbie to give her both ways for less fare? Did she really have to sneak on the bus that one time? So these are the little tidbits you wonder, where does it cross over from what really happened to what's through your mind's eye?
Well, I will just say my mother did not commit suicide. My mother was much more like the grandmother than the mother in the novel. And she passed away of cancer when I was 33. So I just wanted to, I did a book club Zoom appearance yesterday and somebody asked me about that. So it was, and they also asked me something else I won't get into, but I had to clarify that too.
Did they ask you if Jimmy Page was still alive?
No. No, yeah.
I'm sorry, folks. There was just an interview I saw with her where the interviewer asked her if Jimmy was still alive, and I just dropped my head like, oh my God, we're going to do such a better interview with Christy than this poor chap.
Yeah. No, but, you know, in terms of autobiography, the great-grandfather, Jesse, in the novel is named after and based on my own great-grandfather, who actually did try and cure his wife of breast cancer through ritual and prayer, and it didn't work. So there's that, and the fact that I did physically go to all of the locations, the Led Zeppelin locations in the UK part of the book. So beyond that, it's the story is completely fictitious.
Gotcha.
Now, one thing that I will admit to you is that I'm kind of a jerk when it comes to proofreading or making sure that things are what they are. So at the beginning, there's a description of a picture of Jimmy Page from 1973 at Keyser Stadium wearing all white. And I said, wait a minute, stop, Google, Jimmy Page, Keyser Stadium, 1973. Oh, there he is in the white suit, fantastic. You could have said dragon jammies and people would have been like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I remember that. No, you went back and did the research. Thank you for being correct and true on this. Because I'm somebody that's like, if that was wrong, I would have gone, great, that's not right. You're making this up.
Page, you got to get it right.
Always had that particular photograph is taken by Neil Preston. Graph for Robert Plant from Kezar Stadium in 1973. He's on stage and there's a dove in his hand. Neil Preston took that as well. So it's that same concert, same series of photographs. But that photograph always intrigued me. And it for me, kind of crystallized that duality of Jimmy Page. There, he looks almost saintly with his arms spread out and all in white. And so I knew that I would use that in the book as a motif and, you know, to sort of emphasize that saintliness about him that the character Claudia really resonates with.
Now, the book takes place, well, it doesn't all take place, but it mostly takes place in 1988 around when he released the Outrider album. Was that a big record for you? Like, did you, okay, so you jumped on that as soon as it came out?
Yes, and you can't see it, but I have it framed up here on the wall in my study. It is the actual album that I bought in 1988. I was so excited when that came out because we're about the same age. I think I'm a little bit older than you guys. But so when the three of us first got into Zeppelin, they'd already broken up. So there's no way for us to actually see them in concert. And we get this, and Robert Plant had been dropping albums, but Jimmy was the one that I was the most interested in. And he hadn't really done much. He did the Death Wish 2 album, and he'd done the ARMS concert tour, which was a little shaky. He was not in the best shape in the world during that.
That's right.
But this was, and they'd done The Firm, and that was exciting. But this was the first solo album, so it was a big deal to me. I was very excited,
Well, and just to give my experience with the album, yes, I remember when it came out, I'm already a huge Zeppelin head, and I'm like, wow, Jimmy Page is making a solo album? Well, I gotta be all over that, you know. But as we've spoken many times on this show about, back then, you know, $15 or $16 for a CD is a little bit of money back in the day. I mean, it translates to like $40 today, which is a lot for a record, you know. So we had this CD shop that would sell you new CDs, yes. But then if you decided it wasn't for you because of the expense, you could trade it back in to get something else.
Oh, wow.
And so I did buy Outrider, and I did listen to it several times. And, you know, at the time, I don't even know if I had 20 CDs, probably not 25. and, you know, this is a big expense. And, you know, I had, like, the Beatles' White Album, and I had Physical Graffiti and Led Zeppelin 1. It's like, so you had to be very CD-worthy at this point in my CD collection. And I just determined that, gosh, that's not one of the top 20 or 25 records of all time. So I got one of those Maxell cassettes, and on one side, I put Outrider. I recorded it on my stereo from the CD, and I turned the CD in.
Okay.
So to this day, I still don't own it. Sorry, Jimmy. And you know what? I didn't make I didn't make a terrible decision. It's not his best. I mean, if you even if you look at whatever happened to Jugula that he did with Roy Harper, that's way better than Outrider, in my opinion, even though it's really weird and haunting and sometimes a little hard to listen to. It's still amazing music.
Well, do you think, is it the music for you or is it the vocalist? We've got John Miles and Chris Farlow and there's one song
by Robert
Plant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then three instrumentals, right, with no vocals on it at all.
Yeah, Liquid Mercury, Rites of Winter, and Emerald Eyes.
Whoa, look at her go, Jackson.
Yeah, no, she's got it. She is on this. But part of me, for me, is I don't really like John Miles. I mean, his voice just kind of sounds generic. I was kind of thinking, I wonder if you swapped out John Miles for Paul Rodgers.
I think it would have been better. Yeah. I'm with you. I like the music.
Yeah.
But I've never liked John Miles. You know, it's just, rest your soul.
There's nothing wrong with his voice. He's got a great voice. It's just kind of generic. Whereas Rodgers has that rock and roll voice.
Yeah.
My other problem on this one is you knew when it came out, it was never going to be anything but a passion project. I mean, you weren't going to tour with three different vocalists. But the other thing was, I remember, like, because Now and Zen came out, what, in February of that year?
Yep.
And Jimmy did a couple of tracks on that. And then Robert Plant is on this one. So they did the Live Aid thing. So was this going to be a reunion maybe coming up? I mean, it would happen eventually, but not now, not in 1988. But that was kind of in the back of my mind, like maybe that could happen at this point in time.
Well, they did. They played together. I think it was 88 at the Atlantic Records birthday party.
Right.
Yeah. So I remember watching that, and I've still got that on VHS. I recorded that when it came on, and I was just, there they are. It was just so exciting.
I know, but they weren't great, right? I mean, that's the thing. Like you mentioned, by the time we all got into Led Zeppelin, they had been long gone, right? And then what did we get? Well, we got a little taste at Live Aid. The fact of the matter is, we haven't seen any real Led Zeppelin since, you know, we got into them, right? We were kind of talking about Live Aid. It was okay, but Phil Collins didn't really hit it. He didn't really know it as well as he thought he did. The 1988, the thing you were talking about, the Atlantic Records thing, well, they kept pushing them back and pushing them back, and I think they were tired and or drunk, and so it didn't even go off that well. Not to mention, I think Jason was pretty sauced up. They played at Nebworth in 1990, I think it was. And you got to see Wear and Tear, which was cool, cool as hell. But, you know, it's just
and
one
Misty
of...
Misty Mountain Hop.
Yes, but it was only just a couple of things. And then, yes, they did their thing together, Robert and Jimmy, but there's no JPJ. And they're not, you know, and they had obviously reworked some songs for their own thing. But so I think that the whole, the last thing they did at the O2, just do once. The fact that they didn't tour again, I'm still very happy about. Yes, I would have gone out and seen it and spent more money than I needed to. Maybe quit my job and gone to every show. I don't know. But the fact that it's in reverence to them, they stopped in 1980. They never did another tour. They did a few one-off things, and they did one really well. They did Celebration Day, and it's very good as a video, and it sounds good. And it's a great place to say, you know what, that's it. I know they were thinking about doing it afterwards. And smartly, Robert said, nope, I don't need that. I just don't need it.
I agree with you 100%. I am so glad they didn't go on the road, because it was like adding the exclamation point at the end. You know, it's like, hey, remember us? Yeah, we're badasses. This is what we can do.
That's right.
And what they sold, what? I think there was a lottery and 20 million people applied.
Yeah, or 30 million. It was crazy. Yeah.
It was huge. Yeah. So that's your exclamation point on your career. Why go out and do a tour? You didn't tour after Bonzo died.
Right.
It didn't make sense to me that they would even consider it.
Not to me either. But I mean, if somebody said you can each have $150 million for a year of touring, you'd say, all right, well, that I don't really want to, but $150 million? Yeah.
Oh, come on. Those guys are so rich, they don't need that.
Well, John Paul Jones could probably use a little bit. Maybe, you know, he probably doesn't need $150 million, but...
Okay, we'll start a GoFundMe for John Paul Jones.
Well, yeah. No. And married to the same woman for 55 years. Smart man.
That's so
great. Yeah.
Yeah. He chose well, evidently.
Meanwhile, Jimmy's dating a girl named Scarlett, who is half his daughter's age, who is also named Scarlett.
But she's quite a talented poet, and you know they did that collaboration on the album Catalyst, which is, I don't know if you've heard it. It's really interesting.
A little different.
And I think, you know, his musical accents on that are interesting, and I like a lot of her work. So I'm not gonna bash him for that.
No, my dad would. He, you know, he's like, she's 50 years younger than him. That's just wrong. I'm like, well, Dad.
Hi, this is Christy Alexander Hallberg, author of the novel Searching for Jimmy Page, and you're listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast.
It's just, you could tell in the book that there had to be some kind of connection between you and Led Zeppelin / mm-hmm. Jimmy Page. It wasn't you just pick something and were like, eh, you know what, whatever this sounds. I've got an angle on this. You could definitely tell there was a connection between you and the source material. And back to that thing about the pictures, I think that's part of Page's attraction too, is that he was so photogenic.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, like, we talk about, like, American rock stars versus European, mostly English rock stars. Mm-hmm. Like, if you didn't know Jimmy Page, you had no idea who he was, and you met him in a pub one night, he's just this kind of – he just sounds like an understated English gentleman. You'd never
right.
know that he's not David Lee Roth. If you met David Lee Roth, you'd know he was, you know, hey, hummina-bummina-hibbina-hibbina.
Right, yeah.
It's just not the same. It's just – you could – so you've kind of got that. You can live in two worlds. You could be this kind of, you know, quiet, understated person, and then go up on stage and blow people's heads off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was that contradiction when you see him interviewed – not just hear him, but I think it makes a difference. You have to see him interviewed to see how uncomfortable he looks in interviews. He's always touching his face or fidgeting or whatever, but he is clearly more comfortable on a stage with a guitar strapped across his shoulder, and that's his domain, and he's a monster on stage. He's just incredible.
He is that. He is amazing. And he did tour for Outrider. I mean, I went back and looked at the set list. You know, as I told you, Christy, and to let you know, Jackson, he was supposed to come to Louisville and play this place, Broadbent, which, I think was a 5,000 or 6,000 seater, but it was all general admission. And they canceled the show because nobody had bought tickets ahead of time, or not that many sold ahead of time, because it's all GA and what's it matter. But he did do some dates. He did some dates around America and in the UK. And he had a pretty good mix of, he did like four songs or something like that from Death Wish, which I'm still not super familiar with, but I recognize the names. He did a couple of Firm songs. He did obviously a bunch of songs off the new record, about six or so. And then he did some Led Zeppelin tunes, including, not shockingly, but a little surprisingly, he would wrap the show with an instrumental Stairway like he did on the ARMS concert.
ARMS tour.
Mm-hmm. Which you know, is surprising but not shocking. And, like, he ended Custard Pie, which is my favorite, like, non-hit, like, underrated Led Zeppelin song, just shows them off so well. Then Train Kept a Rollin', which we love, old Yardbirds tune, and the Aerosmith used to do a killer version of Train. And then Stairway, I'm like, well, that's actually a pretty hot way to end a show, man. It might have been pretty fun to see that, but there is not much evidence of it anywhere.
Yeah, gosh, and that's wild to me that shows got canceled because of a lack of ticket sales. Oh,
I know.
Hard to imagine.
I know.
I think it was at the time, there was a whole nother generation of people who had grown up with Led Zeppelin, but not, you know, Jimmy Page. I don't know. Times were changing. I mean, in 1988, you know, now we're into, like, Whitesnake. And so it's more.
He doesn't sing. Right, Jackson? He doesn't sing. He's not the singer.
Correct.
Right.
That's correct. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure that the Plant albums did okay.
Yeah.
I know he had some hits on the radio. So maybe that's what it was. If he had gone the same way and had the one singer on there, like Paul Rodgers, maybe that would have been different. I mean, it is a little kind of hard to sell a record with several instrumentals on there. If you had one, okay, fine. But this is a couple. Like I said, I think this was a passion project.
Mm-hmm.
While we're talking about this, Wasting My Time, the great fretless monster, Tony Franklin on bass on there. Mm-hmm. We're a big fan of him on this show.
But he was on the whole album.
To see him work with different people, including getting back together with Robert Plant, even though that I don't think that song's all that great. The Only One.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Vocally, I think it's the best, though. I just prefer his vocals to the other two.
Absolutely.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. But it is cool to hear Jimmy play some real nasty blues too, though, because you know that's where he came from. You know, he was a little kid, you know, sitting in his bedroom listening to those records and playing along with them the best he could, and then, you know, developing his own style because of that. But everybody wants to be someone when they're a little kid.
Yeah. Well, do you remember seeing the video for Wasting My Time?
Oh yeah.
That was exciting too when that came out. I would get home from school and just park myself in front of the TV and just wait and hope MTV would show it before dinner.
Exactly. Now you can just watch it anytime that you want. But yes, I remember they're like, oh, it could be next, it could be this is well, I'll sit here and watch, you know, whatever's on here now for 2 seconds until it comes on there.
Yeah.
But switching gears real quick, I have this note. I wanted to bring this up. So when the main character gets to London, she makes her way to London. There is a switch in the way that she starts to not even speak, but she starts to use language from England. Like she starts to talk about crisps and going to the loo, and I'm like, oh, she's fitting in over there. You know, she's only been there for a day or two.
Yeah, she's picking up on the lingo.
Correct. Yeah.
Like the first time she mentioned the lift, she said the guy Peter who works at the front desk at the hotel where she's staying, the lift, as Peter called it. So she's trying to kind of pick up on, oh, people, and see, language is very important to this character because she's a writer. And very literary. So it would make sense that she'd have an ear for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm sure Mac, you can attest to this too. Like, you know, you kind of want to fit in a little bit, you know, you don't want to go totally native, but you know, if you walk around and say, where's that elevator at? Oh, well, obviously you're not from around here.
No, where's that elevator at, y'all?
Yeah.
Then that would be problematic.
You're right, though, Jackson. I mean, you got to pick up some of the little colloquialisms here and the rhythm of the speech and stuff like that. I'm not going to put on some phony British accent to try to fit in. That ship has sailed, you know? but yeah, I can pick up the language. Let's talk a little bit about Luna here, you know, a young girl in the South. And where I grew up in Louisville isn't, the Southerners wouldn't call it the South, but people from north of Louisville would call it the South, I feel like. It's certainly, and I spent a lot of time in places like Tennessee and down further south in Florida and stuff. We obviously went to college in Florida, so we know a little bit about Southern culture. And you talk about a girl in the 80s growing up, you know, about the same time we did, who is a little bit different, right? She's got the pale skin, and then she starts doing different things with her hair, either coloring it or giving it a mohawk or whatever. In the South, it's so, the kids have to fit in to so many boxes. The person who's just the least bit of an outsider can really get shunned. It's just something that we've experienced, and I know when you write about that stuff, exactly what's going on, right? And then, yeah, you're allowed to have the one black friend, like the one family that's fairly well-to-do, like they get to fit in. But it's like, okay, so racism is over because now we have the one black family and we're just not going to talk about what happened, you know, back in the day, which was really only a couple of decades ago, you know.
Yeah.
All that's very real.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you mention race, and Luna's best friend is an African American girl, and I thought I would be remiss not to address racism to one degree or another in a book, the first half of which is set in the South in mostly the 80s, some scenes in the 70s with flashbacks. I thought at the same time I don't want it to take center stage. But I don't think in this day and age it would be responsible of me to just ignore that. So I didn't want it to be a big part of Luna's relationship with her friend Connie. So what I could do is indict whiteness, so to speak, by talking about it in terms of their families and their history.
Mm-hmm.
So that their core relationship, that's not really a factor for them, but it's in their history. Like with Connie's parents, who had an episode on Luna's grandparents' farm. So that's there. And I also say at one point that in 1980s North Carolina, we wanted to pretend like it never happened. You know, like that sort of racism. We're a post-racial society, and that's something way far in the past. And that was not my experience growing up. It was certainly hush-hush.
Right.
But it was definitely there. And it was just more covert. And so I wanted to in some way touch on it in the book without it taking over the book, because that's not what their relationship's about. In fact, Connie's very much a mother figure for Luna in a lot of ways.
Yeah, even one of the real heroes of the story, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the way it was kind of in Reagan's 80s throughout a lot of the South and the Midwest. It's like, okay, there's no more racial tension anymore. Like you say, it's post-racial. So now we're not going to get into that. We're not going to be confrontative. Nobody's going to say anything nasty to each other in public, as far as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's not like anything just instantly changed and it was over, you know. And Connie's parents, yeah, they grew up, you know, on the farm working hard, but they became professionals and became members of the country club. So then they were,
look,
we've got a black family in our midst now. So we're not racists anymore, you know.
Right.
But still see, you know, underneath all that, and still to this day, obviously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So did you say you didn't consider North Carolina the South growing up in Louisville?
No, it was people from North Carolina wouldn't have considered Louisville the South because we were too far north and, you know.
Okay, yeah.
I grew up in Connecticut. I'm like, to me, that's all the South. If it's like south of like New Jersey, it's the South. So it's just interesting to have different, even though we're the same age and we've got a lot of similar experiences and similar kind of mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of funny when we hit that, like, oh, we didn't grow up exactly the same way.
Yeah.
That's for sure in America. Yeah, absolutely.
Hey guys, this is Ryan Condal, the executive producer, writer, creator of House of the Dragon, and you're listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London podcast, and you should download and subscribe. Keep doing that.
So you made your own pilgrimage over here, right?
Mm-hmm.
To check out some of the sites. And I got to tell you, knowing where all his homes are, although that's something I probably would have done in my teens or 20s, like doing that as an adult, like to really kind of search down, well, where did he live and where, which part of town and what's it look like? That's a pretty big fan right there. Tell me about your adventures coming over to the UK here and to all the spots that you went to.
Well, it started out not having anything to do with a book. My mom died in 2003, and I took that very hard. I had a really difficult time with that. We were incredibly close, and I really went into the bell jar for a while, I think. And I was working on my MFA in creative writing, and my creative thesis was to write a novel. And Jimmy Page was a part of it, but it wasn't, that book was not in any way set in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and it was not the same story that Searching for Jimmy Page is. I went over to England the first time to sort of deal with my grief.
Okay.
It was like I needed to do something to shake myself out of that spiral I was in, and it needed to be something completely out of character, and I needed to do it alone. I'd never been out of the country before, but I got a passport. When I heard about this guitar contest, Jimmy and Brian May and Dan Hawkins of the Darkness were going to judge at the Hammersmith Palais, which is no longer there anymore.
Okay.
Which, Mac, you probably know that. But I heard that they were going to judge this contest for charity during the summer of 2005. And I thought, that's it. I have to go. Because he kind of became the gatekeeper for me to healing.
Okay.
Like if I could, this person who has been such a mainstay in my life and a part of my relationship with my mother and my brother, and if I could make that journey alone and be in the same room with him and speak to him, as silly as that sounds, maybe I'll have the strength to go home and start over again. And that was my thinking. So that's what I did. I got over there. I got a ticket to the guitar contest.
Okay.
And a lot of what happened to me, really, and that's what happened, how I put it in the book. I got through security and I'm standing there in the vestibule and I would know his voice anywhere.
Right.
And I heard it. It, you know, it's like God with an English accent. And I'm going, what the hell? Because surely rock stars are going to come in through some other
the back
portal.
Underneath. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He walked in and was standing just a few feet away from me, and my jaw dropped, and I must have looked like biggest imbecile. I'm just standing there like I've come all the way just for this moment, and I couldn't say anything. So,
what do you say in that? I mean, you're dumb. You know, it's, what would you say? I don't know. I love you. I don't know. What would you say?
I didn't say a word, and off he went to the VIP room. And I got as close as I could to the table where he and Brian May and Dan Hawkins came out and sat at this table kind of in the middle of the room to judge the contest. And I got as close as I could and just stood there. And then he went backstage and they're conferring, and then they're going to come out and go up on stage and announce the winner. And I'm running along behind and kind of at the lip of the stage, right at his feet instead. I took some photographs. They're terrible, but I have some photographs of that night. But I didn't, my last chance came when he was going to leave the building, and he came out of the backstage area, and people swarmed him, and they're shoving stuff for him to sign him, and he's standing there looking like a deer caught in the headlights, which is kind of weird because you think he'd be so used to this.
Right.
But, and we were shoulder to shoulder. We were touching. I'm just standing there. Now he's quite a bit taller than I am, only 5'1". And so not really shoulder to shoulder, but we were right up against each other. I'm just kind of standing there. And then he starts running down the hall or kind of trotting off with his bodyguards, and something clicked. I thought, I'm never going to be in this space again. I'm never going to be in this moment again. And you came all the way. You might as well go for it. So I just started running after him.
Wow.
And I caught up with him at the stairway, the top of the stairs, and he must have been going down to a car park or something. And I screamed the only thing that I could think of, which was, Jimmy, I came all the way from America just to meet you. And it was so weird because I can put myself back in that moment right now and remember it well, how dumb I felt. Like that's not the most, I don't know, erudite or articulate thing to say, but there you go. And he stopped and he looked at me, and I'll never forget, he smiled, but just with his whole face, and he just smiled, and then his bodyguards kind of urging him on down, and he said, I'm sorry, and he split, and that was my encounter with Jimmy Page, that just those few moments, but they made quite an impression on me. That stayed with me.
Wow. I have to say, in the book, when it kind of mirrored the book story, mirrors kind of what you went through. I'm reading the book, and you know, she's describing it as my chance is slipping away, and I won't have it again. And I'm reading the book, like, no, go after him. Don't let it slip away. You came all this way. Do it. Come on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was. That's nice to know that was a personal story for you, because to have that moment too, you want to. I was talking to a guy the other day, and he met a professional golfer, Heinrich Stenson, and just at a charity thing. But I'm like, well, how was he? He was like, he was the nicest person, and that's what you really want. That 1 second of, you know, just, I'm going off on a tangent here, but here's my thing: the reason that Jimmy Page can live in that house and drive these fancy cars is because of me.
Yeah.
I'm the one that bought your records. I'm the one that did all. So for 2 seconds, that's what I need. Hey, you know what? Love you. Appreciate you. And then just go off. I can't stand the you know, well, you know, I don't owe you anything. You know, you kind of do owe me something, right, sir? Yeah, a little something. So the fact that he at least engaged you, like, I mean, were you going to get invited to his house for dinner? Probably not. In my mind, maybe, but probably not. But you need to have that 1 second of, you know, him just acknowledging you and engaging with you. Yeah, I would have been like, I would have just freaked out. I would have just, I mean, cars could have been crashing behind me. Everything's okay. I'm euphoric.
And good for you for doing it. You took the opportunity and you went and did it. I mean, I would probably have been standing there, there goes Jimmy. Man, I wish I would have met him when I was this close to him. Oh, well. So good for you.
Well, thank you. But that has formed the backbone of not only this book, but I wrote a memoir before I wrote Searching for Jimmy Page. And anyway, let me backtrack. I did that trip and then realized the book I was working on for my MFA was really not something that needed to come out. It was a learning tool.
Okay.
And then I met my late husband and we got married, and it was like I was coming back to life and enjoying being alive again and being happy. And so I really didn't do much writing at all for several years. And then he got diagnosed with cancer and I lost him in 2014. And so it was like that personal tragedy happening all over again. And I thought, all right, I'm not going to go back into the bell jar this time. So I think, like Luna, I used art to try and heal. And Jimmy Page was all wrapped up in that. I used music and my own writing. And I threw myself into writing a memoir that kind of focused on that first trip to England and what that was like. And wrote that book, did another two more trips to London or to the UK, and wound up going to Tower House and to Windsor, to Old Mill House, and went to John Bonham's grave outside Kidderminster. And this is not in the book, but when I did go to Kidderminster to his grave, I was the only person there, and his sister showed up, Deborah.
No way.
And it was amazing. She could not have been kinder to me. And we're standing there in front of her brother's grave, these two women who had brothers who were rock drummers, granted on a very different level. But so we didn't talk about, you know, Crazy Bonzo, the rock star. We talked about John, her big brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about Steve, my big brother. And it was a beautiful moment. And before I left, she hugged me and thanked me for coming. And I didn't put that in the book because I thought that was just too coincidental to work in fiction. So left that out. And that's just for me.
Good for you.
But yeah, so I went to all of these locations that I wrote about in what became the novel Searching for Jimmy Page. And I even spent some time at Bron Yar in Wales. I didn't put that in the book. Maybe that's another book. I don't know.
Wow.
But that was great too. I got to a hotel there outside Machynlleth and asked the person working there to get me a taxi cab to take me to Bron Yar. And it just turned out that the taxi cab driver was the grandson of a woman who used to run an inn in Machynlleth. And Robert and Jimmy would come down because there wasn't any running water in the cottage, Bron Yar. Okay. So they'd come into the village and they'd go into her hotel / pub and shower and whatnot. So that was interesting. But
wow.
Got there and people just happened to be in the yard when we got there and they invited us in. So I got pictures all inside there. And yeah, so I 2018 was the last trip I made, and I made it to Inverness, outside Inverness, to see
Crowley's
Leskin House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so, had that burned? Did that happen? I guess I didn't realize.
Yeah,
that.
It burned, I think, in 2015, but it didn't burn to the ground.
Okay.
It burned again after I was there, I think 2019. So it's sustained significant damage, but from what I understand, they're trying to rebuild.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
But do you find it, when you started to go, because I mean, it just seemed like every time you would go, that Luna would go looking for one of his homes or looking for Bonzo's grave. It, you know, the person like, oh, you're looking for John Bonham's grave. Oh, you want to see the stairway where they recorded When the Levees Were. Oh, you want to know where Pagey lives. And it was that kind of thing when you would say, okay, well, I'm looking for the old man. Oh, you want to see where Pagey lives. You know, was that pretty common?
Pretty much.
Yeah,
pretty much. In terms of Headley Grange, I was going to go back to London in 2015, and I'd orchestrated everything so that it would be 10 years to the day of my first trip. Because the first trip I went dealing with my mother's death in 2015, I was going dealing with my husband's death. And so the symmetry became very symbolic and important to me. I tracked down the owner of Headley Grange online and wrote him a snail mail letter and told him my story and said I would be in the UK at such and such a time. And he wrote me back and invited me to come. So unlike
Very nice.
Luna, I didn't have to crawl over the gate. Got to go in, and I got to actually walk up part of the Stairway to Heaven and go in the parlor and see the fireplace where Robert supposedly sat writing the lyrics. And it's such a...
Ooh.
God, such an amazing, magical place. You walk in and there's this aura. There's an energy there. And I could tell that the guy was so proud of that. You know, he's explaining, well, they strung the microphones, or Jimmy strung the microphones over the banister, and they've got the drums in the area there. And he was very proud of the history.
As he should have been, man. That's amazing. Yeah. Jackson, I could geek out on that like all day. No.
Oh, I know.
Go ahead, Jackson.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I was going to say that part of the book where she goes to the house with the Stairway to Heaven, and I mean, we did a whole show on the fourth Led Zeppelin record, call it what you will. You know, the other thing too is I was going to say at the beginning she recalls a story from her when she was very young about this song, and this is what I like, the song about owls crying in the night, the rainbow's end, rivers running dry. You don't say four sticks. Right. Because a child wouldn't understand that, but a child would remember the lyrics and then move it forward. So I thought that was kind of cool too, just how this whole deal of it's something you can listen to as an adult, but it just permeated her life so much that I thought that was cool that you could put it in the book without ramming it down people's throats. Like, it was a good back and forth. Like it peppered the story, but it wasn't. And then, you know, he played a Gibson, you know, Les Paul. Okay, we go, thank you. You know, so it was just enough. But then I think, too, the mark of a book like this is, could somebody read this who had nothing, who had no stake in it and had no and I think the answer is yes. Like it's an engrossing story about something, like, you just read it to see what's going to happen at the end. And I think it's an adventure story. It's a story about family. You know, you can kind of relate to that, too, even if you didn't go through the same things. And the connection between the daughter and the mother who left her at an early age but imprinted on her and felt there was a very strong connection. I mean, like I said, I don't read that many books, but I found it engrossing. And even though if you describe to me what was going on, I'm like, I don't want to read that book. That has nothing to do with me. But you get into it, and like I said, you're like, come on, you know, I'm invested in the main character. Let's go. Let's do this. Let's have this adventure.
Wow. Well, yeah, I'm glad you said that, because to me, the book is about so much more than chasing down a rock star. It is about that mother-daughter relationship. There's this undercurrent theme of motherless daughters. The grandmother lost her mother at a young age. And so there's this, and the role of fathers or non-existent fathers, or you know, what's their role in there? And I think ritual plays a big part in this story as well.
Absolutely.
Both Claudia and Luna sort of look at music as a very sacred thing. And there always seems to be some sort of ritual involved. Like if when Luna decides to go into Claudia's room, there's a ritual aspect of that, like playing the music, lighting the candles,
right,
having the incense, all of this sort of thing around music and music being sacred and people who make the music being sacred. So there's a lot of that. And I think the story is also about how these characters, Luna in particular, uses art to construct her own personal narrative. So there's that blending of fact and fantasy. And who do you want to be? And is that already prescribed? I mean, are you predestined to be who you're going to be? Are you marked at birth, like Claudia says? Or do you create your own identity? So it's very existential in that respect. But I don't know how many people have said to me, I never heard of the song Four Sticks before this. You know, people who've read it who weren't big Zep fans. I never heard it before. So I went and pulled it up on YouTube and listened to it. And it's a really cool song. And I'm thinking, you're welcome, Jimmy.
Absolutely.
And you know, honestly, that's kind of one of our things. I've got a friend who I work with who's probably 10 years older than I am, and yeah, and I told him that we did this, and you know, he's like, "What? You guys do a podcast? What's wrong with you?" And so he listened to the Led Zeppelin 4 podcast that we did, and he was like, "Man, I hadn't listened to that record in probably 25 years, but I put it back on. I remembered how much I loved it."
Yeah.
And like, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing this. If one person could say, "Hey, you know what? That is a great record. Like you said, Four Sticks. I've never heard that song before." I bet you have. I bet you have heard it before.
Yeah, you just don't know it.
You just don't know it. And then you're like, "Oh yeah, I remember this. This is great." And they've got more stuff, and you just kind of lead them down their own rabbit hole, and get them to experience music. And that's back when there are a couple of different references that you make. One of them was, you know, talking about, what was it? "I'm Black and I'm Proud." Just different.
Yeah, the James Brown song.
Yeah, and just how music just imprints on different people, and it can be such a just a part of people's lives, whether it's something that you've heard before or relate to or not. The camaraderie is there with, you know, you love this record, I love this record, and it just, it's more than just music. It kind of just gets into your pores and goes from there. And if you can turn somebody on to it, that's fantastic. And
right.
They come back, oh, yeah, I love that record. Yeah, I know you love that record because it's awesome. You're welcome.
Well, I listened to the podcast on the fourth album that you guys did. And Jackson, I think it was you who said you usually skip over Black Dog and just go right to rock and roll. And I do that too.
Yeah.
I love rock and roll. Just, you know, that has such incredible energy. But I think what you were saying, what you meant was that Black Dog got so much airplay.
We've heard it.
Like Stairway, right. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Four Sticks means so much to me. And also Battle of Evermore and When the Levee Breaks. Those are my favorite songs on that album.
Well, and it's really cool, too, because you hear When the Levee Breaks, and especially when you hear the story about them, you know, they probably recorded it somewhere else
you know,
in the house, and they're like, nah. And then, you know, in the stairs, and then you get that, like,
that sound,
freight
that
train.
Echo, yeah.
Yeah. Like, just, and to be with Jimmy, you know, and that's it. That's exactly what we're looking for right there. Like, yeah, hit them as hard as you can.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're going for. Yeah, it's just crazy.
Well, as we mentioned on that show, Four Sticks was the only song off Led Zeppelin IV to not go on the 1990 box set, which was huge for us. We were still in high school, and we listened to the heck out of it once we lived together in college. You know, it was like huge because I didn't have every single Led Zeppelin record at that point yet, and now I had this collection of, you know, something from all of them. But then we also mentioned they did play Four Sticks when Jimmy Page and Robert Plant went out together on the road, and that's a concert we got to see together in Orlando with the Orlando.
Wow.
Central, the Orlando Philharmonic, really special for us. And we, you know, it's one of those things we never really thought would happen, but we'd always hoped and prayed. And then we did get to do it together. Like, oh man, this is so amazing. Now, did you eventually get to see Jimmy play?
I saw him with Robert Plant in 1998.
Okay,
so that was at Virginia Beach, and that was the second tour that they did together as just the two of them. And I can't remember now if they played Four Sticks, but it certainly didn't have the orchestra with them on that tour.
Right. It was more it was more like a Zeppelin show. It was like four guys, maybe five at some point, you know.
Yeah.
It was more straight ahead like that. Yeah, absolutely.
But I've seen the video, of course, the video of the unleaded show that they did, and Michael Lee, boy, he's no slouch on the drums.
He
handled that really well.
He was amazing. He was one of the best drummers since Mitch Mitchell, as far as I could see from that.
Right.
It was pretty impressive. But see, here's the other thing, though, because yes, I did see that tour as well. Jackson and I didn't see it together, but I got to see that in Jacksonville. We did have tickets to see Coverdale Page at the Orlando Arena. And that show was canceled too. And we thought, and there were rumors. A was, of course, they didn't sell enough tickets.
Yeah.
B was because on the Universal lot in Disney, Tawny Kitaen had some kind of America's Home Videos nonsense show or whatever. So it was like, well, Coverdale didn't want to come to the same city as Tawny. I'm like, well, he could have stayed pretty far away from Tawny. I don't think that's the reason. But yeah, we turned those tickets in, man, and got our refunds on those. I wish I would have saved the stubs.
Yeah, I was less excited about that album when it came out. I mean, anything Jimmy did was okay with me, but David Coverdale?
Well, that's what we said at first, but the songs are pretty good. There's about four really good songs on that record.
I'll tell you what, I was in the same camp. I was like, David Coverdale, come on.
Yeah.
When Jimmy goes into Shake My Tree,
at
the beginning of that acoustic book, I'm like, and sold, take my money, here we go.
He's back.
Because he lights it up on that record. And then, you know, to go into Plant Page after that, yay.
I know.
And then my favorite was when they went, I think it was Kennedy Center Honors.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that they knew that Jason Bonham was going to be there with Heart to play Stairway to Heaven, to see the look on their face, like they're just weeping. I'm like, stop it.
That Kennedy Center performance was amazing.
Really,
I mean,
nice.
all of the acts were good, but the Heart, Jason Bonham cover of Stairway is just, with all the choirs, it's amazing. And
he's
and part of the
he's got the drum, the symbol on the front of the drums. Oh yeah, and I think Ann Wilson too was like, she was like, this is probably going to be a big mistake because this is a really hard song to sing, and she nailed it.
Awesome. I always thought that instead of going out with or instead of recording with John Miles and Chris Farley, Jimmy should have picked a woman. I always thought he should have gotten somebody like Ann Wilson and gone in a different direction. And because Robert took so many interesting, his career has taken so many twists and turns,
right?
And he's taken a lot of chances. I think how interesting it would have been if Jimmy had maybe focused more on acoustic for a little while, or gotten a female singer instead of going with somebody like John Miles, who's just this kind of prototype for the hard rock male singer.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about the Plant Alison Krauss deal?
I like it.
I think I like it. It doesn't sound like it would work.
Yeah, but it does work.
Yeah.
I've seen them at the Palace in Louisville.
Oh, how is that?
It's fantastic. And then Robert came and played the Palace more. I think Alison Krauss had probably a Grammy-winning live album that they recorded at the Louisville Palace, you know, back in the day. Because you have to be named like Quincy Jones and Beyonce to have more Grammys than Alison Krauss does. And so when she goes there and she likes it. So I've seen Robert with her. I've seen Robert solo there as well. And then I saw him on the two different tours with Jimmy. What do you think? Okay, so question about you and question about Jimmy. What do you think Jimmy's next move ought to be musically? And what are you going to do to follow up Searching for Jimmy Page?
I've actually started working on a sequel, which surprised me. I thought initially I've mined this territory for all it's worth. I don't really know what else there is to say, but the character Luna wouldn't leave me alone. So I think I don't want to say too much because I've just gotten started and I'm not one of these writers who outlines. So I don't know what I'm doing right now. I just know that when I started working on this novel, I had the first chapter and the last sentence, and that was it. I mean, I had a rough idea of what would happen, but getting from A to Z was quite a journey that I feel like I took with Luna. So I'm not sure how this next, this next book will turn out, but right now she's a big part of it. What should Jimmy do next? I have no idea. He's become the keeper of the Led Zeppelin flame.
That's right.
And I'm glad he's out there doing that. I have no idea. I've given up thinking that he's going to hit the road anymore. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, the guy's got a history and a catalog that we'll be talking about, or people will be talking about for 100 years, you know. So he's made his statement, and anything else is icing on the cake.
Fair enough.
The nice part about the book is there is it's called Coda, the end of it.
Don't say too much.
No, I won't spoil it, but what I will tell you is it kind of brings you up to speed in her life, and it to me it left the door open for what's going to happen next to this character. It wasn't like it to me anyway. It didn't seem like okay, and the end, and we won't talk about her anymore. It seemed like you were ready to kind of go with her where the journey was going to go next.
Yeah, I didn't plan it that way. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it ended, and I thought, well, that's the end of that. But there's some other things brewing for Luna, evidently. Okay.
Because there are, I know there are like, there are, well, it's probably more movies than books, but like, you know, you watch the movie and like they open it up for a sequel at the end, but it's kind of like ham-fisted, like, come on, you're just doing that because this kind of just seemed organic. Like I wanted to know, I guess I didn't, but then you were telling me and I'm like, okay, this is interesting also. And yeah, where are we going from here? This could go somewhere else. So I would be interested to know what the next adventure is or the next chapter.
Well, here's a little tiny teaser.
Is this an exclusive?
Yes. The new book will involve Connie's adult daughter, who is Luna's namesake. I'm thinking now that there might be a parallel story involving Connie's adult daughter, who is named Luna. I'll call her something else. Mm-hmm. And a backstory involving Luna's great-grandmother, Emily, who died at the hands of her great-grandfather.
Oh, wow.
Beyond that, and you know, I just, this stuff comes to me as I'm hiking in the woods or walking the dog or something. I'll have a moment and go, oh, I can do that, or that might happen. So there's not a whole lot of planning involved. just kind of what, you know, we're taking my dog for his first puppy class in a couple of hours. Something will probably hit me when we get in there with all these crazy puppies running around. There'll be a dog in this book, probably.
Well, good. We love dogs here on The Wolf. You know, and we appreciate, I mean, look, obviously you went through some personal pain and tragedies in your life, and you've turned those into a triumphant book about, you know, a young woman growing up a little differently, maybe in the South, but, you know, finding her own way and creating a less ordinary life. And I think that's really cool. I think a lot of people can relate to that. You don't have to be a girl from the South. Although if you were, I think you'd love it. But you don't have to be to relate to, you know, overcoming obstacles and finding out who you truly are. So I recommend the book to anyone out there.
Well, thank you.
I would say the same thing. Like I said, I can't even remember the last time I read a book. You know, we booked this. You reached out to us, and I was like, I got to read this book now. So, and I was going along like, hey, this is interesting. I'm not forcing myself to do this. This is an interesting story. It's well written. It's the chapters, some of them are nice and short, so I can feel like I'm making progress.
Right,
so that's good. Yeah, and it's just an easy read. It flows pretty well. Use some big words. They have to look them up a couple, but it's not overbearing with the big words. So it's very accessible.
Good. Well, thank you so much. And my own story has a happy ending. I got engaged a little over a year ago.
Yeah,
so I have a new love in my life, and he has been amazing and gone to all of my readings and been a part of all of this journey since the book got accepted for publication. So it's a good time for me.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great coda.
Yeah, I've been married for 20 years now. And so it's stories like this where you're like, oh, yes, my husband and I, he left me flowers on the, okay, now I got to step the game up because, you forget about those things after a while. But that's good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, and where can people find the book? Where's the best place to go? You have a website, you have social media. Where can people find you?
Yeah, if people just want to go to my website, there are all kinds of options for how to get it. I mean, there's Amazon, which is the big boogeyman for a lot of people. So if you'd rather shop indie bookstores, I say, yeah, definitely go that route. But you can find all kinds of links on my website, which is www.christyalexanderhallberg.com. You can just go there and find it. If you want to just do one-stop shopping, that's the place.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
Or anything, any other final words or thoughts or plugs or something we failed to cover?
I don't think so. This has been so enjoyable. I was really nervous, but I've had a great time. You both have been wonderful to talk to.
Thank you.
Well, you know your stuff when it comes to Jimmy. And, you know, Jimmy, we hold in very high esteem. You know, I mean, just rock god.
Me too.
It's one of those questions that if I thought about it, my answer should evolve. Right? Like, who's the best rock guitarist of all time? I just say Jimmy Page. I've said that for 35 years because it's like, you know, what's the capital of Texas? Austin. Who's the greatest rock guitarist of all time? Jimmy Page. I mean, I don't have to think about it, but probably my taste should evolve or change, or I should, you know, over time, like, no, man, okay, no. What he did with the electric guitar in those 12 years is pretty damn special, you know, and especially from when we grew up in the 80s watching MTV, did anyone who played the guitar on MTV not see Jimmy Page and take something from him? I don't think so.
Right. No argument there.
There's a clip of that show he was on with The Edge and Jack White. I think it was called This Might Get Loud. And he's just talking about it's him by himself, and he's got the Les Paul, and he's playing. He's just playing along. He's like, oh, the tactile sense of the guitar. And he's playing, you know, he's playing the beginning, the Ramble On. And then he, you know, and then he flips the switch down to the bridge pickup and then just goes into it. I'm like, I could watch him do that all day long. Just tell me about how you play it, how you put the songs together, how it's just a, you know, it's a part of him. Like, it's like doing this with your hand, you know, him playing the guitar. Like, I'm sure he's not even thinking about it. He just does it. And to your point, Mac, you know, you're talking about, like, when you watch especially the early, like, Def Leppard videos, Steve Clark wants to be Jimmy Page. Like, he's got the look, he's got the guitar. So it's just that next evolution of, yes, who is the greatest guitar? it's Jimmy Page. Mm-hmm. Don't even have to think about it.
And I think he looks great these days. He stopped dyeing his hair. When he was dyeing it jet black, I'm like, come on, Jimmy. We all know you're 50. I mean, what's it matter, you know? But that white hair, and he's usually got a smile on his face. I'm like, he looks good considering what he did to himself in the 70s.
I think he looks fantastic now. I agree with you. I love that he stopped dyeing his hair. There's something so distinguished looking about him now. He's our rock's elder statesman, and he exudes such dignity. He looks so happy right now.
He does.
He looks like he's in a good place.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, have you ever seen him? Like, you never see him in not, like, a suit. Like, he always is just like a gentleman. Like, mm-hmm. you never see him, like, in just, yeah, exudes coolness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Scarf like, around his
I think
neck.
I one of those
know.
Guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go. If you went to if you went to the bar, you wouldn't know that he was a rock star, but you'd be like, there's something about that dude.
Yeah.
You get to know. He sounds really cool. Like, kind of just, you know. Man, yeah. Billy up there. What's going on? What's your story?
Oh, yeah. Guys, I really appreciate this. You've just been wonderful, and I've had a great time.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Well, that wraps up our show with Christy Alexander Hallberg, author of the novel Searching for Jimmy Page, which I have to tell you was a really fun read for me. For a guy who does not read a lot of fiction, I thought it was great. And the good part is you don't have to be a young woman from the South growing up in the 1980s to appreciate it. But it might help if you like Jimmy Page and you like the music of Led Zeppelin, which certainly we do. And I know a lot of you out there do as well. So whether it's on her website, whether it's on Amazon, maybe go to your local bookstore, we definitely encourage you to go out, pick up a copy of Searching for Jimmy Page by Christy Alexander Hallberg. And what a thrill that she was our first guest as a member of the Pantheon Podcast Network of Podcasts. We are so excited to be a part of this great family of talented podcasters and musicians, producers, writers in their own right. We can't wait to unveil some really fun stuff that we have coming up for you in the months ahead. So please stay tuned and remember to subscribe and download wherever you get your podcasts, whether it be Good Pods or Apple or Spotify or Stitcher or iHeartRadio. Wherever you like to get podcasts, Google's been good to us, Amazon's been very good to us, but please do subscribe and download, and if you're enjoying the show, please give us a 5-star review or a positive review at any rate. It just helps us find more rock and roll fans like you and helps us get more resources in for our show, which is what we are all about. Now, as usual, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Did we miss the point? You have to let us know. You can tweet us at @ugly_werewolf or @actionjack72, and you can DM us. Let us know what we may have missed, or let us know which bands or records or concerts, which rock and roll properties you would like for us to review. Now, coming up next week, Jax and I are very excited to rate an album that is very close to our hearts, but is not really big in the Pantheon, not Pantheon Podcast, but the Pantheon of Great Rock Records in a lot of rock and roll fans' eyes. That's Momentary Lapse of Reason by Pink Floyd. Yes, it's the one after Roger Waters left the band. It's kind of derided as a David Gilmour solo album. But because it hit us in our teen years, it was really our first exposure to Pink Floyd in a new record. It means a lot to us. And of course, the Delicate Sound of Thunder follow-up live album was huge for us. And it's why we did show number 3 on Delicate Sound of Thunder. So you got that to look forward to. Plus, you might be able to hear us on some other podcasts coming up, where Jax and I might sit in and do some guest appearances. So thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to all of you for downloading. Thanks for all of your support to help get us onto this great network of podcasts in the Pantheon Podcast Network. And know that in the future, we've got a lot of fun stuff coming up for all of you. So wherever you are, all you rock and rollers all around the world, until next time, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.